Tropical Storm Isaac is heading slowly towards Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and then possibly to Florida. Chris Lancey is with the National Hurricane Center.
The areas that have the highest risk of being impacted would be essentially the whole Florida Peninsula and the Panhandle. So that would be the Keys, Tampa, Apalachicola. The east coast of Florida is a bit less at risk at this point.
The Republican National Convention opens in Tampa on Monday, and officials say they're looking at various contingency plans to handle the storm and the convention simultaneously. In Haiti, the government and aid groups are trying to keep people safe from Isaac. They've got a big job on their hands because hundreds of thousands of people are still displaced by the 2010 earthquake. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of NPR journalists all around the world whose stories take us there every day.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, whose 29th season features a 90th birthday celebration for composer George Walker. Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 hosts The Planets, Bach's St. Matthew Passion, conducted by Fred Stoltzfus, and Rush Hour in April. Ticket information is available at 333-6280.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
Egypt's last queen, Cleopatra VII, is certainly one of the most famous women in all of world history. But our guest for this hour, Stacey Schiff, says we remember her likely for all of the wrong reasons. While her name has become associated with sexual seduction in her time, she was regarded as someone who was a very able political strategist, a brilliant manager, and a very tough negotiator. This morning in this hour of Focus, we will be talking with Stacey Schiff about her new biography, Cleopatra, A Life. The book has just come out. It's published by Little Brown. And there are a lot of fascinating things here. She is a very compelling character, particularly once you get to know what we can know about the real Cleopatra. Our guest, Stacey Schiff, also has written biographies of the wife of Vladimir Nabokov, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize, and also a biography of Benjamin Franklin. She is talking with us this morning by telephone. She's out traveling around the country to talk about Cleopatra, and we're pleased that she could be spending some time with us. And Stacey Schiff, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
I really was, right away when the book came in, I thought, I would think I want to do this. I'd like to have the opportunity, both because my first reaction was, well, here's someone who was certainly a very famous figure from world history. But then my second thought was, well, what really do we know about her? We have all these images that come from popular culture. But I think what you would say right off is that a lot of that is simply not correct.
That was one of the things that drew me to the topic as well, was, you know, here's this incredibly familiar name. It's a brand name. And yet we seem to not only have it all wrong, we seem to be incredibly ignorant. I mean, Cleopatra and Nefertiti seem to be sort of the same person to us, but mm-hmm. there are 1,300 years which come between the two queens.
And I think of the many surprises that people will get when they start to hear more about the story, one of the things right up front that they'll be surprised about is the fact that Cleopatra was not Egyptian.
Right. Cleopatra descends from the greatest, probably, general of Alexander the Great. And so these are all Macedonian Greeks. And he is the general who essentially helps to conquer Egypt, realizes that Egypt is the jewel in the crown, is the most fertile country in the Mediterranean, and essentially installs himself as a new pharaoh there and begins a dynasty, the Ptolemaic dynasty. And Cleopatra, 300-ish years later, descends directly from that Greek general. So, in mm-hmm. fact, yes, she's a Greek woman living, ruling an Egyptian country. It's been compared sometimes, and I think not badly, to Britain's rule of India, where you have one ethnicity essentially superimposed on another.
Yeah. And just to touch again to that point where somehow we have these two women that we like to associate, Nefertiti, who truly was Egyptian, and Cleopatra, who was Greek, but also that the Egypt that probably we think about, the ancient Egypt we think about, pyramids, Sphinx, Ramses II, all as far as Cleopatra was concerned, that was as much ancient history for her as she is for us.
that was one of the things I had so much fun with, was threading, was realizing what an expanse of time we're dealing with. That by the time Cleopatra sees the pyramids, they're covered in graffiti already. I mean, they've been restored already. They've been around so long. And that, you know, history, even in her day, there was such a thing as ancient history, in fact.
Mm-hmm. So that, I'm sure that points to one of the challenges for a writer for writing about something like Cleopatra, that first of all, it's a long time ago, but also the world in which she lived is so different.
It's so different and so hard for us to disentangle. I mean, I guess for me, the best example of that is the contrast between Cleopatra's Alexandria and Rome, which at this point, at the point at which she is born in the first century B.C., is the rising power in the Mediterranean, and obviously will be the ruling power for the next hundreds of years. But Cleopatra's Alexandria at this point is still, and will remain for a little bit longer, the center of culture, the seat of learning, the sophisticated, gorgeous, decadent, cultured city, whereas Rome is a provincial backwater. There is nothing, the Colosseum isn't built yet, the Pantheon isn't built yet. If you wanted an education, you went to Alexandria. And Alexandria is the seat of the great library, obviously, but also the place where the great thinkers have been, so that all the great advances which have come about, you know, understanding the value of pi, the fact that the Earth was round, all of these ideas that we'll forget for another 1,500 years have really been explored in Alexandria.
Mm. And it was so rough, was a very, Rome was a very rough place. And also, if you're going to be a woman in the ancient world, you had your choice, you would much rather be an Egyptian woman than you would a Roman woman.
You probably would have preferred to have been an Egyptian woman to a woman anywhere else in the world. And that, too, is something we've thoroughly lost sight of, I think. In Egypt, well before Cleopatra, women have rights of all kinds. They're almost on an even footing with men. They inherit equally. They run businesses independently. They enter into their own marriages. They're entitled to alimony. They initiate lawsuits. They own papyrus marshes. There's this amazing equality. And it makes it easier, obviously, to be a female ruler of Egypt when you've got that kind of parity between the two genders. But it's something that strikes the Roman world, certainly, as just backward and paradoxical and somewhat puzzling.
Yeah. As you pointed out, Cleopatra was Greek. She was the descendant of the first man named Ptolemy, who was a general of Alexander the Great, because Alexander conquered Egypt, then the Ptolemies, I guess Ptolemy the First looked around and thought, well, this is a pretty nice place. I think I'll be king.
It's a great job if you can get it.
Exactly. And apparently that was good enough for Alexander, so the Ptolemies ruled. Now, she was culturally Greek. She was educated as an upper-class Greek woman would have been. Why is, in understanding her, why is that important?
Well, it means that I'm trying to think what the modern comparison would be. It essentially means that she has the best education money can buy. And the best education money could buy in the first century B.C. was a thoroughly Greek education. It meant you were steeped in Homer. You knew the Iliad. You knew large parts of the Iliad by heart. You had read your Aeschylus, your Euripides, your Sophocles. You knew your Aesop's fables. You had learned a lot of rhetoric, how to deliver a speech. And this education was very consistent, whether you grew up in Rome or Athens or Antioch or Alexandria. It was absolutely consistent across the board. There was it would be like the French school system, where you learn the same thing on the same day in Paris as you do in Martinique. So that education was something Cleopatra would have shared with Cicero or with Caesar, with the very influential Romans with whom she later deals, so that our sense of her as this exotic Egyptian woman from a different background is totally wrong. She would have been, the conversation at a dinner party would have been very consistent between what she was used to and what Cicero was used to in Rome. There's a very, very even footing there, and there's a very constant set of references across the board.
Yeah. Well, that gets us to this issue, perhaps, of her seductive qualities, the things that has come down to us as being her strong suit. At least, you know, that's what the Romans wrote, and they didn't really care much for her anyway. When you think about that and think about her, and particularly these two very important, very powerful men that were her partners, you think about what it would have been about her that attracted them. It seems like it would not be her physical beauty, but it would be everything else about her.
precisely, although I think we're looking at it from a modern perspective, you know, to some extent there. Certainly the classical writers pay tribute to the fact that it is her charm and her intelligence, her the irresistible presence the irresistible charm of her presence that enchants the Romans, or that enchants anyone, as much as it does anything else, more than her beauty is what they make clear. And if you look at the coin portraits of Cleopatra, which are the only accurate depictions we do have, they do seem to support the classical writers. She does not look like Elizabeth Taylor, alas. She has a very hooked nose and a strong, prominent chin and sunken eyes. She looks very authoritative, but she does not look like someone whom, certainly by our standards, we would deem a great beauty. On the other hand, Plutarch in particular makes clear that the intelligence shines through, that there is a sinuousness and a seductiveness in her conversation which is irresistible.
Mm. And it's interesting choice here, whoever made the choice for the jacket of the book. The portrait of the woman on the cover is, we have a woman whose hair is done in the Greek manner, and she's dressed in the Greek manner, and she's facing away from us, so you can't see her face, and since we don't really know what she looked like, and we have this sort of air of mystery that still surrounds her, I think all the way around it was a pretty good choice.
I thought it was quite brilliant too, David. It's based on a coin. I mean, we know that Cleopatra wore pearls in her hair, and we know she would have worn a diadem, a piece of ribbon around her hair to denote the fact that she was the ruler. The earring is based on real Hellenistic jewelry, although it is in fact a fake piece of jewelry, obviously. And the garments would have been Greek. She wouldn't have dressed as did Elizabeth Taylor in the movie. She would have dressed with a mantle and a tunic, as a Greek woman would have. And obviously, she faces away because the one thing we don't know is what her face looked like.
Yeah.
So there was no choice.
She, all at the same time that she, as you say, she was culturally Greek, it seemed that she really knew how to wrap herself in that Egyptian mystique, and how to use that, and that was something that worked for it. It works now; it worked then.
Yeah, there's a wonderful, well, there are a couple of wonderful things that she does, I think, strategically, which point to what a serious grip she had on power. One is that she learns Egyptian. She's the first of the Ptolemies, first of the rulers of her dynasty, to be able to speak to her subjects in their own language, which, I mean, you can imagine what an impression that would have made after hundreds of years of, you know, basically not being able to communicate with your ruler. But she also comports herself and conflates herself with the goddess Isis, who's the sort of the earth mother of the day. She's a sort of conflation of Athena and Hera and Demeter and all of the great goddesses. And she has an enormous popularity in the whole Mediterranean world at this point, but particularly in Egypt. And Cleopatra plays that imagery out very, very deftly, and it wins her an enormous amount of support among her people.
Our guest in this hour is Stacey Schiff. She is the author of a new biography of Cleopatra. The title is Cleopatra, A Life, and it's published by Little Brown, and she's out now talking about the book. I'm pleased that she could be with us. And questions are welcome. We do have somebody here ready to go, and others you can call in, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And our first caller is in Indiana, and line four. Hello.
Hello. I'm sorry I got in a little late, so I just fast realized you're talking about Cleopatra. But you were talking about women's rights and things of that sort, so I'll go ahead and ask the question. I wonder if you could give some summation, particularly very recent history of the woman mathematician, Alexandria Hypatia. If she fits into any of the situation you're talking about at all. Thank you.
What we know of Cleopatra's world is that there were an extraordinary number of advantages that any woman had, and that some women did actually manage to become physicians, become philosophers, become poets, become mathematicians. So, again, from the Roman perspective, this was all incredibly unorthodox. But from the Egyptian perspective, that possibility was there. The educational possibility was there, and the ability to perform, to be able to lead your life as a physician in Alexandria was entirely possible for a woman.
Mm. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Others are again, certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think that trying to it can be very difficult to understand people who've lived at other times, particularly people who've lived in a place that's so very different and so long ago. At the same time, I think you have to make the assumption that, or some people make the assumption that the kind of experiences people have, the things that they worry about, the things that they think about, what they want, what they feel, it's not really all that different. And you've, I think, really made the argument that if you want to try to understand Cleopatra, it's not so difficult if you think about the kind of difficulties that women who were in positions of power now face.
Yeah, I went both ways on that one. I mean, one of the most difficult parts is that you're reconstructing a world that no longer even geographically exists. I mean, Cleopatra's Alexandria obviously is gone. It's been, there are bits of it in the ocean, but otherwise it's wiped out. Her palace is gone, the museum is gone, the lighthouse is gone. The culture is different, the language is different. The Nile isn't even in the same place as it was. It's 2 miles further east than it was in her day. I mean, there's just physically very little to go on other than the light and the tides. Mm-hmm. At the same time, what comforted me and what I did indeed rely on a lot, as you infer, was the consistency of human nature. And for example, in Cleopatra's dealings with Cicero, it's very easy to understand how these two came to dislike each other, or he came to dislike her so intently. Very little has changed in the way that we deal with each other. Very little has changed in terms of foreign policy. So it was fairly easy to sort of fit along those grooves. And if you could think away the propaganda to some extent, to be able to see how Cleopatra dealt with the people around her.
Well, that does point to the problem that so much of what was written about her was written by people who clearly were not admirers of her.
Yeah, I mean, if you want something good written about you, it's better if you win the war. You know, the losers don't get depicted terribly well in history. And this is a case where, I mean, she has several things working against her. I compare the fact that it is Roman men universally leaving us the story of a Greek woman. And I compare that to, you know, a British life of Napoleon. I mean, it's just, there's not a chance that it's not going to be skewed. Moreover, these are sources writing later. Plutarch is writing 100 years after the death of Cleopatra. Moreover, she dies just as Latin literature has come into its own. So images of Cleopatra, that noxious, decadent Eastern female and her snake, make their way very quickly into Latin literature, which we still read today. And she serves Octavian, who defeats her and becomes the Emperor Augustus' political purposes beautifully, in that she and Mark Antony are allied in the 30s. And Octavian needs to declare war on Mark Antony for the future of the Roman Empire, what will become the Roman Empire. And he has an easier time declaring war, obviously, on a foreign woman than he does on his ex-brother-in-law and fellow Roman, because he'd rather not be fighting a civil war. So from the very start, she is painted as this ambitious, grasping, poisonous, and dangerous woman on whom Rome needs to wage war. Mm. And that is the beginning, I think, of the propaganda against her.
And someone whose primary weapon was sex.
Exactly. I think actually the romantic thing, you know, it comes in later and it gets built on and built on. I mean, the romantics, Shakespeare obviously did a great job with that. The romantics did a great job with that. And Elizabeth Taylor is just the icing on the cake at that point. But she gets more beautiful and beautiful. She gets more and more beautiful as time goes on, I noticed when I was working on the book.
There certainly must have been an official historical record kept by her court. Do we just assume that the people who came after her decided that they would like to write the record and all of that was just destroyed?
Absolutely. I mean, the great irony here is that, as I say, Alexandria was such a civilized and educated city, and the Ptolemies, very history-minded. So there would have been a court historian, and there would have been massive records, surely. There would have been massive accounting records, if nothing else, because you're talking about a very tightly controlled economy in the country. Not a shred of that has survived. So there's a terrible irony there. There isn't a shred of papyrus that survives from Cleopatra's Alexandria. And what we are left with instead are the inimical accounts from the Romans. Yeah. But yes, there surely would have been people writing at the time and in obviously more objective terms of what was happening with Cleopatra, and all of that is lost to us today.
So in trying to get to understand her and what a tough individual she must have been. You have to give people an appreciation for what family politics were like among the Ptolemies, and the fact that she could manage to survive in a family where there was a great deal of bloodshed and incest, and if somebody was in your way, you simply killed them. You know, the idea that she could survive, manage to triumph, and get rid of a few siblings along the way, she must certainly have been a very, very tough person.
Exactly. I mean, there are five siblings to begin. And granted, this was how court politics generally proceeded at the time, but there were five siblings. The eldest, Cleopatra's elder sister, usurps the throne when Cleopatra is a young adolescent from their father when he's away. And on his return, he, of course, murders her, which leaves Cleopatra and her next youngest brother ready for the throne, to which they ascend on the death of the father. Within months, the two of them are engaged in a civil war, and that is the civil war in the middle of which Caesar arrives. That brother will die very conveniently in the middle of the civil war, at the end of the civil war, which leaves two siblings. Caesar, as a favor to Cleopatra, will send the next youngest sister away to what is modern-day Turkey, because she has also attempted to undermine Cleopatra. And later, Mark Antony will, as a favor to Cleopatra, murder that sister, which leaves only the very youngest brother, whom Cleopatra will herself allegedly poison in the next few years. And the only consolation there comes from Plutarch, who makes a lovely remark about how empire was an utterly unsociable enterprise to begin with, and this really was standard operating procedure in the best of families.
It's pretty clear to see what she was thinking about with wanting to have some kind of alliance with Caesar. So here she is. She's fighting for control with her brother. Caesar arrives, so he's the big power in the neighborhood. And so what she's trying to do is, not only is she trying to secure her own power in the struggle that's going on with her brother, but she's also interested in trying to maintain, to the extent that it can be, the existence, the independence of her country, as Rome is continuing to expand its power.
Precisely. At the moment that she ascends to the throne, she inherits the problem her father had had, which is that Rome has essentially expanded almost to the borders of Egypt. It has gobbled up most of the surrounding countries. It has dethroned sovereigns, and it looks like it's about to do the same to Egypt. So the question of autonomy is first on her mind. The civil war with her brother at the point of Caesar's arrival is truly at that juncture where she is about to lose. I mean, he has an enormous army. He has the support of the court. He seems to have the support of the aristocracy in Alexandria. And she has been out in the desert, and this too speaks to what kind of person Cleopatra was. She has been out in the eastern Sinai, where she has raised a small mercenary army of her own, and they are 200 miles east of Alexandria. And frankly, she's about to get clobbered. And it's at that point that Caesar, fresh from his own civil war with Pompey, will arrive in Alexandria. And she will, in the famous scene we all know, if perhaps incorrectly, from Elizabeth Taylor, mm-hmm. she will smuggle herself into the palace to beg, not to seduce him, as you would think from the movie, but to basically beg for her life and to beg for her throne.
And she, if people, again, will remember either the movie, or I think it's actually a story that predated the movie. The story was that she was rolled up in a carpet and was brought in. Somebody carried the carpet in and unrolled it, and there she was. Well, apparently what she actually did was she had herself stuffed into a sack and carried in by someone. So actually, it's pretty close to what the truth of the story really
it's
was.
It's pretty close. We don't know if the actual unveiling took place before Caesar. I mean, I've compared it. You know, I've said that the unrolling of the carpet was like the original Girl in a Cake, where she pops out to seduce him. And mm-hmm. in fact, it's just a matter of smuggling herself past the enemy lines, past the barricades, and into the palace. And we don't know if she pops out of that bag in front of Caesar. But what we do know is that, A, it's a surprise and very cunning arrival, which must have thrilled Caesar no end, and that within a matter of days, she and Caesar have come to some kind of terms with each other, so that by the end of the Alexandrian War, as it's called, the end of the battle against her brother, she will both have her kingdom back, and she'll be pregnant with Caesar's child.
So clearly they did have a relationship, and she had a son by Caesar. So it's real clear what it was that she, at least in a political sense, what it was that she gained from having this relationship with Caesar. What did he gain from having this relationship with her?
Well, he needs Egypt for one very, very important reason, which is that Cleopatra is the most fertile country in the Mediterranean, and she controls the greatest grain supply there is. And it has been said that she single-handedly could feed Rome, therefore she could also single-handedly starve Rome, had she wanted to. So Caesar's interest in Egypt, there had been a long-time interest in what are we going to do about Egypt. It's this enormously rich country. It's this enormously fertile country. On the other hand, you know, do we control it or do we not control it is what Rome is wondering. If we put someone in control of Egypt, the Romans ask each other, what will that person do? It's very easy to launch, you know, some sort of assault on Rome. It's easy to undermine Rome from Egypt. So it made more sense to have whoever was on the Ptolemaic throne be somewhat at your beck and call and be a client king or queen, as indeed became the case. What Cleopatra had to gain, obviously, was the favor her father had spent decades trying to gain, which was simply the Roman consent to maintain his autonomy. So they each have a very strategic interest in the other when they first meet. And although you could say there must have been a love affair there of some kind, it is a very shrewd strategic alliance on both of their parts.
Well, when he brought her to Rome, so he was already married, so he brings this woman, this Greek woman, who was the queen of Egypt, by whom he has this child. How did people back in Rome feel about all of that?
You know, we have no record of how they feel, except that we know that Cleopatra's hairstyle was very much copied when she was in Rome. But there I do think you can make some inferences. I mean, it's inexplicable to me that that Caesar would have invited Cleopatra to Rome. It's a huge political liability, it would seem to me, to a man who is being accused of comporting himself like a monarch, who's being accused of too much enjoying these divine honors that are being heaped upon him, to have the Queen of Egypt living in his villa across town with their mutual child. It just seems as if it's a very tone-deaf political move. On the other hand, we know she wouldn't have been in Rome. Cleopatra wouldn't have been in Rome had Caesar not invited her. So clearly this was an invitation of some kind. It would seem to me, she's there, she's in Rome when Caesar is murdered in 44. And it would seem to me that on some level, her presence must have exacerbated the charges against Caesar. But we have no record of that. It would also seem to me that a woman who lived amid the kind of opulence that she was used to would have had trouble getting used to Rome, which was a much more monochromatic, much more simple city than the one she was used to.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Stacey Schiff. She's the author of Cleopatra, A Life, a new biography of Cleopatra VII of Egypt, published by Little Brown. She is also the author of the book Vera, which is a biography of the wife of Vladimir Nabokov, which won her the Pulitzer Prize. She's also written about Ben Franklin. And in fact, she talked with Celeste Quinn about her Ben Franklin biography back in 2005, and that interview is on our web archive if you'd like to go back to listen to it. Well, if Caesar had not been killed, you know, who knows what would have happened here, but he had the bad luck to be assassinated, and so it was also her bad luck that he dies. And that leads her to the involvement with Mark Antony. And here what she was doing was she was allying herself with one person in a struggle for the control of Rome, a struggle that he eventually lost. And, you know, one might ask the question, well, was that really the smartest thing to do?
I mean, it's interesting what happens. The fallout after Caesar's death is very murky. I mean, everyone, it seems, has an interest and an army and is attempting to basically carry on the mantle of Caesar. And Cleopatra very shrewdly waits it out. I mean, she gives a little bit of support here and a little bit of support there, and she basically temporizes to see whom she's going to ally herself with next. Obviously, it cannot be with the assassins of Caesar. It has to be with someone from the other side, but there are a number of options. And ultimately, Antony will become the Roman in charge of the East, so he's obviously the person to whom she more or less reports. And the obvious option. And he will summon her many, many times, in fact, to essentially come to see him in southern Turkey and to some extent to explain why she has been so slow to ally herself with him. And that is the trip that you may recall from Shakespeare. That is the wonderfully theatrical trip of Cleopatra slowly making her way up the river in this golden boat with the billowing purple sails amid the clouds of incense, with the lyres strumming and her maidservants addressed as Cupids and nymphs, and she arrives as a sort of goddess in front of Mark Antony. And if there's a way to basically say to a Roman military commander, I am not at your beck and call, and I am greater than you, and I don't usually answer summonses, that's a pretty good way to do it. And moreover, the other advantage that she brings, and this answers your question about Caesar as well, is mm-hmm. she still controls the greatest fortune in the Mediterranean world. She is the richest man or woman in existence. And Mark Antony has some great military plans in mind. He can't go east, he can't go on that campaign without some kind of funding. And here is a woman who is essentially saying, just with her spectacular theatrical entrance, I have the kind of funding you need.
Mm. And they were a couple, as we would say, for something close to 10 years. They had three children. Again, you wonder, well, what really was this relationship all about? Was this primarily about politics? Or in this case, it does start to look a little bit more like it was about something more than that.
Well, we know from Plutarch that they had a lot of fun together. I don't think there was as much of an intellectual affinity as there may have been with Caesar, because that does not seem to have been Mark Antony's style. But we hear from Plutarch about the pranks the two of them pull in Alexandria, the vacations that the two of them take, about their adventures out fishing together. I mean, we hear about a certain amount of lighthearted, of mirthful carryings on between the two of them. They are together for the better part of a decade. And there are a couple of moments at which Cleopatra does things which would indicate that she really wants to be with Antony. At one point when she's pregnant, she accompanies him far out of her way in the wrong direction, which would seem to indicate that she actually wanted to be with him longer. Mm-hmm. But again, it's awfully convenient that she seems to keep falling in with the most important military commander of the day. So I'm a little reluctant to say, oh, she fell head over heels with this man, or, oh, this was a great and glorious love affair, just because there's such strategic importance mm-hmm. attached to it, and there's so much to be gained from it.
Well, you couldn't. It's clearly in both cases, as far as we know, she was only involved with two men in her entire life, Caesar and Antony.
Right.
And you have to say that they, while these were people that must have seen in one another important, influential, powerful people, and no doubt people like that gravitate to one another for understandable political reasons. And yet, particularly with Antony, you would have to wonder, if these people didn't like each other, if they didn't want to be together, if they didn't enjoy each other's company, would they have been together for so long? And you have to say that there had to be something really more complicated and maybe more interesting going on here than a simple alliance of two very powerful people.
Cleopatra's case with Antony is a little complicated, though, by the fact that once she has thrown in her lot with him, and tensions have begun to grow between him and Octavian over the future of Rome, it's very hard for her to undo that allegiance. Mm. And it's further complicated by the fact, and this is a really messy one, that she has Caesar's son. And Octavian, at the death of Caesar, Octavian is posthumously adopted by Caesar. So he comports himself as if he is Caesar's legitimate son. And as it has been said, you know, there too many Caesars is a bad thing. Here she is, the queen of Egypt, with this half-Roman son who resembles his father, Caesar. And here's Octavian, who's passing himself off as the son of Caesar. And you know, something has to go there. I mean, that just isn't going to work. So at a certain point, she really, whether she would have wanted to or not, really needs to stay with Antony in opposing Octavian. I mean, she and Octavian, in a funny way, cannot coexist.
We have some callers here. Let's talk with them. In Urbana, we have someone here. Line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Fascinating. All right. Now, we know from the Peloponnesian Wars that the struggle between Athens and Sparta was between the matriarchy and the patriarchy. Thucydides is kind of lame on this, but, of course, he was an Athenian. Now, during Cleopatra's reign, was she actually in a patriarchal society? To what extent was she influenced by Sparta and maybe trying to restore the matriarchy? And thank you for taking my question.
I think, first of all, she would have known her history inside out. So there's no question. I mean, we know she would have known her Herodotus, her Thucydides. There's no question there. She, interestingly, is coming at this from a long line of queens. As I've said in the book, she would have arguably had more female role models than any queen in history. So I don't think there was necessarily an attempt to, in some way, support the matriarchy. I think there was really an attempt to maintain the Ptolemaic hold on the throne and to ensure the future of a dynasty. And if that dynasty was going to be led by Caesarion, by her son, so be it. I don't think there was a sense there that it had to be a woman or a man. It was really a matter of fending off Rome as well as possible, continuing the dynasty, and to enriching Egypt's coffers as much as possible. I don't see a real sexual politics playing into it, but then again, our sources are so scant. It's very hard to say. We have no sense of... Cleopatra does not comport herself at any point as if she's aware that she's a woman, but we have no sense of that from the documents we have.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is line number two, and this is someone in Savoy. Hello.
Hello. How did she get to be Cleopatra number seven? Did every girl get named Cleopatra, or what?
The Ptolemies are very uncreative in naming, which is the bane of the historian. All the women in the family are either named Berenice, Arsinoe, or Cleopatra. And interestingly, Cleopatra is not Cleopatra the seventh, or Cleopatra. She's Cleopatra the sixth. But somebody somewhere seems to have miscounted. There were previous Cleopatras. Some of them, all of them, are consorts to previous kings. And that is what's interesting, is that Cleopatra, although she has many female predecessors who sat on the throne of Egypt, she is the only one who rules independently. Those women were consorts to kings. And occasionally, during small interregnums, they may have ruled individually, but she alone, she's the only woman of the ancient world to rule alone. And of course, then with Caesarion, she will do a very smart thing, which is she needs to have a male consort of some kind. And she will elevate little Caesarion, her child with Caesar, to be her consort. So having a male consort who happens to be 3 or 4 or 5 years old is, again, a very canny thing to do, since he's very unlikely to meddle with your agenda in any way.
Did consort in those days also include sex?
There were brother-sister marriages from the beginning of the Ptolemaic dynasty. It's a completely inbred family tree. I mean, Cleopatra's great-grandfather is her great-grandfather three times over. And also, I think, once her great-great-great-grandfather. I mean, it's a very contorted family tree. In her case, she is nominally married to the brother with whom she ascends to the throne on the death of their father, but he's 10. And within a matter of months, the two of them are at war. So I don't think that marriage was not consummated. And again, after Caesar and Cleopatra's victory in the Alexandrian War, she will be put on the throne with the younger brother, whom, as I say, she eliminates. And again, he's younger. She has really no interest in ruling with a child who is not under her sway. And I don't really believe, especially given the relationship with Caesar, that much would have happened there. But yes, these are brother-sister marriages. I think there are 10 full brother-sister marriages, and the rest of the Ptolemaic marriages are between cousins and other relatives.
I suffer, of course, from the movie version.
We all do.
Were there any siblings named Cleopatra for the Cleopatra you're discussing? Or were they all women several years before her time?
The other Cleopatras all predate her. They're women of the previous generations.
Are you able to give me what B.C. dates go for all these Cleopatras?
If you had time, I could. But
not individually. I just mean globally, from the first Cleopatra to the last.
The name Cleopatra begins with Alexander the Great, with whom there are several Cleopatras, and then the Ptolemies, as soon as they arrive in Egypt, will start naming daughters Cleopatra, which means glory of the fatherland, and Arsinoe and Berenice. Those are the three dynastic names that they will prefer. So some of the great queens, some of the great consort queens, will have been named Cleopatra. Cleopatra the Third was one of the great ones.
But before those consort queens, there were some other Cleopatras around that aren't being counted in this numerical system.
Well, in the numerical counting, it would only be the ones who were on the throne, exactly.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and just maybe again to sort of to establish the dates we're talking about, that she died, Cleopatra died in the year 30 BC?
That's right. She's born in 69, and she dies in 30.
Okay. And were all of the men named Ptolemy? Or were there also some other men's names?
You know, all of the men who rule are named Ptolemy. And what's interesting is that Cleopatra has a daughter named, not helpfully, Cleopatra Selene, who will, after her death, go on to marry, Augustus at this point, will set her up with a West African king. And she will become the queen of Mauritania. And she will reconstitute, in a funny way, the Ptolemaic court and all of the Ptolemaic habits in Mauritania. And she will have a son whom she will name Ptolemy. And he's actually Cleopatra's only known grandson.
Hmm.
And he will ascend to the throne, in fact, in turn, although sadly he will be murdered years later in Rome by Caligula.
And so this was this daughter, this was one of the children that she had with Mark Antony.
Precisely. There were three children with Mark Antony, a set of twins and a later son. And one of that set of twins was a girl.
Yeah. And the son that she had by Caesar ends up being killed by Octavian.
Exactly. Again, the problem of too many Caesars. As soon as the Romans can get their hands on him in Egypt in 30 BC, they see it to it that Caesarion is murdered. Cleopatra had tried to spirit him out of the country. She had tried to send him to India to safety. But he's betrayed by his tutor who suggests he come back. And when he comes back, the Romans murder him.
About 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus with Stacey Schiff. She's the author of a new biography of Cleopatra. The title is Cleopatra, A Life. It's just out. It's published by Little Brown. And she is out talking about the book. Back again to a caller in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm curious. Your author who has a new biography, how do you feel about the more traditional classical scholarship of somebody like Michael Grant, who has written quite a bit about Cleopatra? How does it differ from your take on it?
I think the Michael Grant books are fabulous, and I use them quite a bit. The only advantage I had over Michael Grant is that in the last couple of decades, there's been a tremendous amount of research, fabulous research, about women in Egypt and about, for example, education in Egypt. So that what we know, the schoolbook exercises we know in which children copied out passages of Homer and in which girls were studying various things, all of that is new scholarship, which he did not have. And the only other difference, I mean, the big difference with between any two biographies is that I ask different questions. I mean, for example, we know that when Caesar arrives, Cleopatra was camped out, as I say, in the Eastern Sinai with her mercenaries. Caesar is in her palace in Alexandria. How did she get there? And that's a question, you know, I went to a few Hellenistic historians and said, you know, how would you get from Pelusium to, which is the desert, to Alexandria? The current goes against you. You know, you don't have a large ship. The river is heavily patrolled. You have to get behind enemy lines. How do you do this? And they looked at me like I was crazy because they hadn't thought about it before. So it's really a matter of the fact that I asked different questions and, for example, wrote about her education, which no one had done before, wrote about her dealings with Herod at great length because I thought they put in context the kind of challenge she was up against. I mean, Herod, too, as the ruler of a small country on which Rome is encroaching, has the problem of how to deal with Rome. And how the two sovereigns deal with Rome in their very different ways, I thought was very instructive. So I put her in a different context and I asked different questions. But, you know, 80% of the facts are the same facts which Michael Grant certainly would have had. His books are terrific.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. On to another caller, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi, this is from left field, literally. Since you're talking about the way the history is reported, I'm wondering whether you familiar with some kind of revisionist history about Julius Caesar himself. I think this isn't something that Michael Parenti came up with himself. I think there's a strain of this in the discourse, because I remember the idea of the plebeians and the senators, his thesis is that Julius Caesar, for whatever his reasons, was being a little too populist for the Senate, and that he was doing things like cutting taxes on plebeians, and I don't know if he was giving them more political power, but that that was the reason he was killed. I don't know if anything comparable was happening in a very hierarchical society in Egypt, but I know that from reading some things on Nova that this idea of the pyramids being built by slaves is not true, and that they were actually sort of bourgeois farmers who came in and helped construct the pyramids. So this image of the maybe we have some misconceptions of the Egyptian society as well. So I don't know if any of that is something you can comment on, but I think it's fascinating. So I thought I'd bring it up.
All right. Well, thank you.
What's fascinating are the number of reasons supplied for Caesar's murder. And what's equally fascinating, of course, is this idea that once Caesar is gone, everything will just fall back into place the way it was. I mean, no one seems to be bracing. I'm sure this has happened at many other times in history. No one braces himself for what the actual fallout is going to be of this enormously savage act. What I didn't do was pay much attention to modern sources, so therefore I didn't pay much attention to revisionist history. I really went back to the classical sources, to Strabo, to Dio, to Suetonius, to Plutarch, to Appian, and read and reread and reread them to see what we could eke out of the nuances and we could eke out of what they actually told us, so that their reasons for why, the reasons they supply for why Caesar is murdered, or their descriptions of Egypt, became what I based the book on, really, for the most part.
All right. Well, again, we have about 5 minutes left here with Stacy Schiff. Someone wants to call very quickly. We can accommodate the call. Something I want to make sure that we talk about before we end up running out of time is her death, as this is one of the things that I'm sure people would say that they would know. There's the story about a snake, about a poisonous snake, and your conclusion, and I think other people's conclusion as well, that makes a pretty good story. That probably wasn't what happened.
It sort of makes too good a story, I guess, is part of my problem with it. Iconographically, it makes a great story. A woman and a snake go back a long way. So putting Cleopatra in the line of, you know, Eve and Electra and Medusa makes a lot of sense, as does the fact that the snake is the symbol of Egypt, and the snake has been associated with the Isis cult, which I mentioned, which Cleopatra associates herself with. So the snake really works from many perspectives. Practically speaking, first of all, neither Plutarch nor Dio, who both give us the accounts of her death, is sure about the snake. They both say they're not sure, as does Strabo, who arrives in Egypt 4 years after Cleopatra's death. None of them is sure of the snake. But that uncertainty is lost to history because the snake makes such a potent, I think, impression. Practically speaking, it's very hard if you're three women alone in a room, as was Cleopatra with her two servants, and you're used to making crisp and very meticulous decisions, it seems to me odd that you would entrust your fate to a wild serpent. And moreover, it seems that snake could not have fit in that basket. The basket was too small, and the job of killing the three women was too big. And moreover, it would have induced a very painful death. And we know that Cleopatra, first of all, did not suffer a painful death. It was a narcotic, quiet, non-convulsive death. And secondly, that as a Hellenistic sovereign, she would have known her poisons. And Plutarch even tells us that she experimented with her poisons. So she certainly would have picked something, I would think, that would be the easiest way to go. And the bite of an asp would not have fit that description.
Another of the unanswered questions about Cleopatra is what happened to her body.
Yes, I mean, and this one is a hard one because we don't, again, because of the Greek-Egypt divide, we don't even know if she would have been mummified or cremated. We don't know to which set of burial rites she would have subscribed. But the only account we have of the geography is from Plutarch, who basically sets the whole stage in this mausoleum of hers in Alexandria. We know she's buried with great pomp and with Mark Antony, and we've never found anything so far. There is a dig going on just west of Alexandria at an Isis temple that may or may not yield their mutual tomb. We know that Octavian would have allowed her to have been buried with great ceremony, if only for the sake of keeping the peace in Egypt. I mean, she would have been beloved. He was taking over the country. There was every reason to make sure that she was buried in style and with respect. But no trace so far, anyway, of where she's buried.
Mm. Just to finish up, I cannot leave without at least mentioning that there is talk about making a movie based on the book. Apparently someone has optioned it, and there has been a name attached to the project, Angelina Jolie. Apparently has said she's interested in playing Cleopatra.
I think that the Scott Rudin, who's the one who's optioned the book, would be very, very thrilled if Angelina Jolie were to take the role. I mean, the idea is really to play Cleopatra, or to portray Cleopatra, I should say, as a charismatic, authoritative, opportunistic, and smart woman. And, you know, certainly that's something that would work, it seems to me, with Angelina Jolie.
She certainly has screen presence. We'll give her that.
To say the least, exactly.
And it's something, if you can get a name like that attached to your movie, it probably makes it reviewer-proof. People will come to see the movie because she is in it, and it doesn't matter that...
She can be killed by a snake. Nothing matters from there on in, right?
So are you now getting caught up? I also heard you talking about this and saying that what you really... As you were working on the book, you intentionally were trying to avoid a lot of the popular culture references, and that, for example, this the famous movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, you purposely said, "Oh, I'm not going to watch that until I'm done."
Have you gone back to catch up? Only because I've been on book tour, I haven't had a chance to. But they're lined up at home. All of the Cleopatra movies and the HBO miniseries Rome, which I've also never seen. Because I did feel as I was researching, that I'm so suggestible that if I saw some image, that really stuck itself in my mind, I would be unable to unthink it. And I needed to just really immerse myself in the original sources insofar as we have them. And I could look at the bells and the whistles later. So mm-hmm. I hugely look forward to my crash course in Cleopatra films.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to talk after you've seen all that and see if you feel any differently about Cleopatra.
I'd love to.
Just as a way of finishing up, a huge project like this, what do you come away with, particularly in the way that you feel about what you can know about this woman, this real woman?
Well, I'm amazed by her. I mean, it's hard to say that I felt an affinity for Cleopatra, because first of all, I think when you're writing about a royal, it's very hard to get as close as when you're writing to, you know, someone who isn't quite as guarded, or for that matter, someone for whom you don't have materials. But I remain in awe of her, a little bit frightened of her at times. But to think that she holds onto the throne of Egypt for those two decades, despite war and famine and plague and, you know, these incredibly complicated politics that are taking place across the ocean, and that she inherits really a losing hand. I mean, if you look at it from our perspective, you realize it's all over before she really comes to the throne. I mean, Rome is it's on the march, and Rome is going to prevail. And the fact that she manages to hold out as long as she did, and to, you know, survive her siblings, for starters, and then ally herself with these two extraordinary men, it just seems to me remarkable.
Yeah. There we must leave it. It's a great story, Cleopatra, A Life, published by Little Brown, by our guest, Stacy Schiff. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much, David.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned. Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features personalization of wedding accessories like cake knives, toasting glasses, and gifts for the wedding party. A complete online catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies. Support for today's broadcast comes from Wesley Church and Student Ministry at Goodwin and Green in Urbana. A diverse and welcoming community, Wesley holds their Sunday traditional service at 9:30 a.m. or contemporary service at 11:15 a.m. Details at wesleyui.org.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at commodity futures prices as we head into the final hours of this trading week. It's been a very choppy affair, especially in the corn pit. Corn's traded both sides of the open today. For example, September corn has had a high of $8.17 and a low of $8, and it is flirting with those lows as we're doing this report right now. A similar story in the soybean pit. Look at November beans. It's been as high today as $17.37 and a quarter. and as low as 710 3/4, and it is about in the middle point of that trading range thus far today. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. We'll begin in Kansas City, where September wheat is at 877, down 6. December 901 3/4, down 5 3/4, and March of 13, 911 3/4, down 6 3/4. September wheat in Chicago at 867, down 7.5. March 897 3/4, down 6.5. September corn 801 3/4, down 7. December 808, down 6 3/4. March 808 1/4, down 6. And July at 784 3/4, down 6.5. September soybeans.